from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this morning's opening hour, former San Francisco mayor and present California Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom will join us for the hour. We'll talk with him about a range of issues, both local and state, and even get some of his thoughts on the ongoing presidential race. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Gavin Newsom, former mayor of San Francisco and former member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, presently serves as the 49th Lieutenant Governor of California. And as Lieutenant Governor, he is a trustee of the California State University System and sits on the UC Board of Regents, as well as serving as President of the State Senate and Chair of the California Commission for Economic Development. Gavin Newsom joins us in studio for this morning's opening Forum Hour, and good to have you back
here. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. He said it seemed like 15 years since you've been here.
Yeah, right? I know. I said pre-global warming. It's been a long while. You know, when I was mayor, you'd have me back. But now who the heck, what does the lieutenant governor do? That was more information
than
anyone's ever
received. That was the question
that
you asked. That's right. And yet, you know, it's interesting you should bring that up because when you were working for Leo McCarthy, you had a pretty good idea of what Lieutenant Governor
was. It was tongue-in-cheek when I said that. Of course, I paid a big political price being tongue-in-cheek. You're not allowed to be yourself in that context. But it was a stupid thing for me to say because it was used in a commercial against me that I didn't even know. I'm running for an office, and I, quote-unquote, didn't even know what a lieutenant governor did. But you make the right point that I actually was an intern, formal intern, Santa Clara University political science major, and did a paid internship with Leo McCarthy, the then lieutenant governor. So I had intimate familiarity with the job, but I was just having fun at my own expense.
And now it's even more intimate, goes without saying, right?
year in the office. So a lot of boards and commissions, but you're not the executive. And that's, I'll tell you, a huge shift from being executive of not just a city, but a county in San Francisco with a strong mayor system. So it's been a big, big adjustment.
You're still called governor. You have, I think I read where you said there are eight times as many lobbyists in Sacramento legislator.
8.8 now. It's growing. And trust me, that's why it's not a lot of fun to walk the halls at the Capitol, because it's wired. It's hardwired. We just put ourselves on the ballot. It's like we're being auctioned off to the highest bidder, special interest on both sides of the political aisle. And now you've got these super PACs to just make it even more perverse and absurd. It's a serious problem if people care about their
democracy.
You
gave money to Colbert's super PAC.
That's because I wanted to expose the absurdity, the satire. I wanted a public education campaign, and it was better than I ever imagined. I gave that money back in October because I was inspired by the satire and what a job they've done on it. But it's just a serious problem. It was a serious problem before, and it's a serious problem now. And let me say, Michael, there's nothing more significant, and from my perspective, than the influence of money on politics at the local, state, and federal level. But boy, when you get to the state level, you understand it much more deeply. A state of 38 million people, how do you compete? What does Jerry Brown do to get his tax proposals supported? Who does he get the money from? And then what does he do in return for that money? You're seeing it already. And I'm not suggesting it's corrupt. I'm saying the system's corrupt, not the individuals that are in it. Something's got to give. Something's got to change. This existed before the Supreme Court decision, but now it's the point of crisis from my perspective. And I really think at the end of the day, nothing matters more than this fundamental question. What are we going to do about money and the corrosive impact on politics and politicians?
It's been an ongoing crisis. I mean, for years, it's been corrupting the political system. And, you know,
so what are we going
to
do about it?
I want to get on my soapbox about it. I have before. Well, that's the big question. You know, what are we going to do about it? Gets us into a lot of territory. You've said publicly that you want people to believe again. And these two are allied in my mind. You want to focus on what people should believe in. They should believe in government, but they aren't going to believe in government if it has this kind of taint of money to it.
You got it. No, and I understand. Again, and excuse me for trying to be postpartisan here. on both sides of the political aisle. I know as a Democrat, we can stand on our high horse and say, it's just the other side and this corrosive impact of money, but nonsense. Special interest. And by the way, there's enlightened special interest. I'm a big environmentalist. I'm a labor person. And so I admire and appreciate the lobbyists and on that side of the aisle. I may disagree with the lobbyists on the other side of the aisle, but it's not a personal assault. So it's not inherently a bad thing to be an advocate for a point of view. The problem is everyone's in a very fearful environment right now. It's a zero-sum game. We think we have a declining economy, so we're going to hold on to our piece of the pie. And so the interest groups come in this environment. It's very corrosive. It's worse than a cancer. And so what we've got to do, to your point of belief, is frame this in the context of abundance. And so what I've been arguing for in our state is we've got a governor who's doing a very good job focusing on solvency. But what we need is a vision for greatness again. California has always been a state on the leading and cutting edge, and we need a vision to align us with our values and create a sense of spirit, hope, and possibility and get out of this frame of fear, which is the greatest challenge, again, in the context of our budget crisis that we face.
How are you doing in terms of working in tandem with the governor? Because you were critical of economic development, of redevelopment. You were critical of the money that was cut from the UC system.
Hard not to be. We cut $2 billion from higher education in 12 months.
But you're a lieutenant governor. You got to be a good soldier, don't you?
No.
A great degree?
I tried to be for 9 or so months where I, you know, bit my tongue on redevelopment and did some other things. I didn't want to be a cliche. Lieutenant governors and governors have always had a difficult time working together. You know, anyone that knows Jerry Brown, he's not necessarily the most collaborative executive. And I don't think I'm speaking completely out of school, and I don't think anyone should even hesitate to think that was a
shot. It's a very diplomatic phrase, though.
No, it's
just not the most collaborative.
You don't necessarily, I said. So, I mean, the point being, you know, he's a unique person. He's a unique capacity and skills, and in many respects, a brilliant political tactician and mind in terms of looking at the political playing field. And so we could agree to disagree on some policies, but I want to be generally supportive. And look, I think we need to have the most successful governor in California history because this moment in time deserves that and demands it. So I want him to succeed, but it doesn't mean that cutting $2 billion from higher education should not be, one should not receive some critique if someone disagrees with it. And I have made that point loudly and clearly. And taking away redevelopment for all of its pratfalls and problems and for all the amendments and adjustments that could be made to strengthen it to avoid its abuses, it's the one economic development tool that local communities have that they no longer have to be competitive in this very difficult environment. So I thought that was a mistake as well.
Let's go to education, because we talked about President Obama's, it's at this point an outline. The devil is in the details, but the carrot and stick with tuition that he's essentially made public. What do you think?
Yeah, it was a good soundbite, good politics. He's not going to do it. I mean, California
political
would be shut
theater,
down.
You think?
Of course it was, because California would be shut down. We're about to raise tuition yet again. The governor's proposing $200 million cuts at UC, another $200 million cut at CSU. Remember, he cut these budgets three times. Without any, I mean, it's just, you know what I'm stunned by, Michael, is why the heck there's not many of us out there alarmed by this. The conveyor belt for talent in California is its higher education system. It's the reason this economy has succeeded over the last half century plus. We are losing that key advantage. You've doubled tuition since 07. You've tripled it since 2001. You're pricing out the middle class. This is a serious code red crisis. And it's remarkable to me how silent and complicit we are in so many respects on this. $2 billion in the last 12 months. And yet there's still $400 million on the table if the tax measures don't pass. I'm alarmed by it. I'm stunned by it. And so while I appreciate the president saying no more, is he going to offer us resources so the governor doesn't have to make that choice in the legislature? Or what's the alternative? Just to say you're going to cut off money is, I think, a little bit of political theater. Sure, but I appreciated the president saying it, and I'm grateful that he raised the bar of awareness on this critical issue.
Talking to Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, former mayor of San Francisco, you are also, as I said in the introduction, as Lieutenant Governor, part of your duties, economic development, you've been talking a lot about, and You are, in charge of the State Commission for Economic Development, and yeah. I think you've said publicly, haven't you, that you want to blow it up? That sounds like Arnold.
Oh, no, he's right. I mean, it should be disbanded. It shouldn't be under the lieutenant governor's auspices. We need to aggregate an economic development strategy that goes under the governor. We were working very collaboratively with the governor. I put together an economic development plan, hired McKinsey, a big consulting firm, went out and got Brookings, a big policy group out of Washington, D.C., looked at best practices across the country and around the world physically and virtually cased, quote-unquote, under the people's joints, learning about their economic development strategies, put together 38 specific action items. The governor had a different idea of where to go in terms of his direction. So I pulled out of a bill that the speaker was running to consolidate the commission that I was chairing because I still want to be part of this. The governor hired a job czar to move again down a different path than I was hoping. And I still want to be part of this agenda, but I still think it needs to be consolidated. And I'll work with the governor hopefully to do that at another time in a way where I hope I can still have a voice in economic development in the state.
You were out publicly protesting the hikes in student fees and high administrative salaries, and initially you even gave some support rhetorically, at least to the Occupy movement.
Yeah.
Where are you now in the Occupy movement, particularly since we've seen it move in a kind of break toward
it's like the
60s redux, you know, there's the violent and the nonviolent.
I'm just on behalf of my kids and grandkids, I'm here just in debt thanking them for changing the dialogue and changing the narrative. I mean, every year we talk about growing income inequality in this country because every year we come out with a one-day story and a one-day report. You'd have a guest on or two. You probably did more coverage than anyone. And then we were on to the next challenge and crisis. Now we're focused on this disproportionately. And it's an extraordinary thing what the Occupy movement has done to change the narrative and dialogue. And I say that on behalf of all the one percenters as well. Because you can't live a good life in an unjust society. I think it was Aristotle who said that. You know, there's no justice when you're stepping over people on the streets and sidewalks. The point being, we're all in this together. So I'm for the 100%, and I think it's incumbent upon this movement not to be dissuaded by the lack of physical activity out in the streets and sidewalks, but maintain their rationale and reasoning aggressively behind the scenes, not just in front of the cameras, to encourage us to now change policy so we can change course and reconcile their point of view.
They need unity, though. They need a coherent vision, or maybe even some would say they need leadership, and they also need to either keep the kind of tactics initially what they were, civil disobedience, and I'm not talking about passivity, but don't you think?
Well, no, they need their leaders, folks in elected office, to do their damn jobs. They need us to step up and step in. You know, if you're going to listen to someone like Mitt Romney, who has the arrogance to suggest he cares about, this is the quote, "I care about all Americans, period. I don't care about the very poor," as if they're somehow other or separate from all Americans. It's an offensive statement. It's a damning statement. And it's incumbent upon elected officials to step up and step in to carry the message of social justice, carry the message of economic opportunity for truly all Americans, and make the case that the Occupy movement's making that we're better when we focus on supporting one another, that you don't win by someone else losing. And the notion of interdependence is a profoundly significant one. Social justice, economic opportunity are foundations of a coherent and successful democracy. And without a strong middle and a center, we don't have a successful democracy. So thank God for the Occupy movement. I mean, talk about the true American spirit and the American dream and our values. This is what they're advancing. To the extent there's some extreme elements, of course. To the extent there's a lack of focused leadership, fine. But at the end of the day, they've done their job. Now it's incumbent upon elected officials to do their job and to right these wrongs. 16% of Californians, 16.3, live below the poverty line. Families of four earning less than $22,000 a year. 29% of our kids in the Central Valley, our kids are living below the poverty line. And you've got a presidential candidate saying, "I don't care about those people." This is what the Occupy movement's about, but this is what democracy's about. It's what the Democratic Party's about, to step up and step in. And so, you know, again, it's now our job, not just their job, to keep protesting, but our job to actually lead.
You were talking before about Governor Brown's putting taxes on the ballot and alluding to that, and you've said publicly you'd prefer the taxes are raised on a federal level, but there's a intransigence. I mean, Romney, for example, is the liberal or moderate part of the Republican Party.
It depends, you know, the day of the week.
Well, I mean, Gingrich has even codified that. He said, I'm the conservative, he's the moderate from Massachusetts, yeah. And that's pretty much the way the common wisdom goes, that one is leading the really hardcore conservatives and the other the trying to bring together the conservative base if he can. And it brings up the whole question of where taxes ought to come from, particularly when you have Republicans signing kind of it's a pledge that they will not move, not only federally, but of course here in the state. And yet, talk about this for a moment, because the rhetorical argument is, we're allowing people to create jobs. These are job creators. They're not, in other words, they're helping poor people because they're able to create jobs by not paying taxes. How does that equate?
Well, look, I'm a guy who's created over 1,000 jobs, so I know a thing or two about this. It's not an abstract issue for me. The whole idea that I would open a business worried about whether or not the Bush tax cuts are going to expire is laughable. I just, in fact, literally yesterday, we just invested in a new winery in Napa. Not one moment of one day went by where anyone, even the most conservative accountants that we hired, were concerned about the Bush tax rates expiring in terms of creating opportunity and jobs in this state. It's just ridiculous. The idea that the low tax rates, the Bush administration, somehow were the secret sauce of economic stimulus has been proven factually wrong by the actual results of the last decade plus. So at the end of the day, you want to be competitive. At the end of the day, you've got to reconcile where you are in relationship to your competitors as a state, and local government needs to do the same. That's why I do think at the federal level, we need to reconcile our tax system, and we need to move forward with where the president wants us to go. At the same time, though, I do acknowledge you need to be sensitive at a state level and a local level to be competitive in a world and an environment where we have more competitors than we ever have in the past, because you can get to the point where it is a little too much and a little too onerous, and it actually impacts not necessarily startups, but can impact the growth of companies that are at mid-level that are looking to expand dramatically, that may find ways to or make excuses to find ways outside of the state. So, you know, it's a difficult position. The governor is in a very difficult position. He doesn't want to raise sales taxes or income taxes in a state that has relatively high sales tax and income tax. At the same time, we have to make sure we don't see any more of these precipitous cuts. So, again, there's no, you know, I wish there was a soundbite here. I wish this was easy. It's not. But one should be sensitive to it. And I don't think we can just quickly say, let's just raise taxes across the board here or there. I think you have to look which taxes and look at federal, state, and local tax rates and look at the relationship between all three.
Get back just for a moment to national politics, since you mentioned Governor Romney, and always interested in hearing your thoughts about presidential race. Of course, we had an overwhelming victory by Governor Romney in Florida yesterday, although it was preceded by a pretty overwhelming victory in South Carolina by Speaker Gingrich. I'm wondering, though, who do you think would be a more formidable adversary? There's a kind of, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, I sense there's a kind of joy almost among many Democrats at the thought of Newt Gingrich being the opponent. But this may be, and this is, again, a different kind of wisdom, this may be foolish in some respects, because there's also those analysts who will tell you that Ronald Reagan, for example, they thought, well, he had a divorce.
Pat Brown, I mean, who took out former Mayor Christopher in the primary to face
You know
Reagan
what I'm saying
instead.
Here. I mean, exactly. It may be a bit naive and foolish to think, you know, that you're going to have a victory against Gingrich assured.
No, a fair point. Though I am fearful of this ticket, Romney Rubio, in the context that it reconciles a number of things for Romney that make it a very challenging race. I think President Obama will win. I think he should win. I think he's found his voice. I think he's had a fabulous 3 months.
You don't mean a singing voice now, do you?
No, though he has, in fact, a fabulous voice. And if we had a presidential sing-off, there's no doubt Romney would lose that based on his performance yesterday.
Yeah, America the Beautiful. still sort of shudder thinking about that. Let's talk a little bit about local politics here. Ed Lee, you're a big supporter of his.
Yeah.
You're happy with
him taking your torch?
I took
him as a department head and appointed him city administrator not once but twice and supported him. And, you know, it's hard to criticize someone who basically has the entire team that I put into place and is doing a lot of the same things. So I think he's doing a very good job. He's got a very different personality than I do, and I think it was a breath of fresh air after 8 years of Willie Brown and 7 years of of my administration. So I think it's been a very healthy thing for the city. I like his approach and I like his demeanor, and I think those things matter. And I think he's bringing a lot of folks together. So I'm very pleased.
How about what's going on with the sheriff-elect, Ross Mercurimi? I mean, from your perspective,
tough
you
stuff.
Tangled with him politically a lot. Some of the papers have been playing up the politics in that. Do you see that?
I haven't seen anything. I mean, he was accused of something that was rather serious, and he's one of the chief law enforcement officers in our city. So one shouldn't take these things lightly. We've long taken domestic violence very seriously in this city, and we're very proud of the work we've done on that. And I think Ross Mercurimi was part of that. So I think he has to object. Understand the seriousness of these allegations. At the same time, I understand it's difficult for him, and he seems to be, under the circumstances, weathering it well. And I can only imagine, as a new father, and sincerely I believe this, how difficult it is for him to be separated from his son. But those are the rules of engagement. The extent that he's been accused of something, he understands that system as well or better than anyone. So it's tough. It's a little indulgent in terms of just the day-to-day pounding in the media. There's got to be something else to talk about, as important as this is. So I understand his frustration, feeling he's being picked on. But, you know, trust me, I've been there. We all have. And such is the nature of responsibility in the public realm.
Well, America's Cup was very important to you. You must be pleased with things moving along on that scale. But even more important to you and something you became identified with politically were same-sex marriages. How do you feel about, progress or lack of progress on
Amazing.
That front?
Washington State is poised to do something today. New Jersey, we have a governor that's remarkably, Christie, who suggests that rights should be voted on, which is, profoundly ignorant. Thing from my humble perspective in terms of the history of the rights movement. If we voted on interracial marriage in 1967 when the Supreme Court overturned the laws that denied interracial marriage in 16 states, 70% of Americans would have opposed that decision. So subjecting the rights of a minority to the whims of a majority is not necessarily how rights are afforded. So I was disappointed in Christie's point of view, to which he suggests he'll veto the legislation that comes out of that body. But it's very encouraging. And of course, we've got a dream team with Ted Olson and boys that are going to be moving forward to the Supreme Court. And it's conceivable this time next year or late into the next year, we'll be in front of the court, and it will be a very, very close decision, and that will be an extraordinary moment in the history of this country.
Talking again, if you've just joined us, with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who is Lieutenant Governor of the state of California, former mayor of San Francisco, and we're just a couple minutes away. I don't know if I want to bring this up now, but you're talking about campaign finance reform, but your own donations were questioned in a recent Bay Citizen story going back to actually
last
February.
What did I do?
February.
I didn't read it.
Well, I'm reading it here. Alvin Dorman, the owner of a Market Street building proposed as a new headquarters for Twitter, gave sharply discounted office space in the same building to former Mayor Gavin Newsom's campaign for lieutenant governor, a political contribution valued at more than $11,000 campaign finance records show. Weeks right. after the gift last fall, Newsom officials aided in negotiations between Twitter and Dorman by offering the internet company a payroll tax freeze as an incentive to move into Dorman's building. Any connection between the tax deal and the donation?
No. I like the story, though. The reason I like the story is I think people forget that I was very proud of Mayor Lee and that legislation in the Board of Supervisors. I think it's a transformative piece of legislation in terms of revitalizing mid-market, which is something I care deeply about as mayor. My reason for laughing is people sort of forgot that I was part of that and helped organize that legislation. But Alvin is a New York developer. He actually owned the building, sold it to the Shorenstein Company. But those kinds of things, just, you know, all those years, and you've known my local record, 16, 17 years, I don't think anyone has accused me, my worst enemies, of that kind of politics. So that's just not true, and it's not what I do.
Let me open the phone lines. We're less than a minute away from our break, and you can talk to Lieutenant Governor Newsom. Governor, actually, is the technical title for the Lieutenant Governor. We welcome your phone calls. It's toll-free 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us now at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can register your questions or comments that way, or you can go to our Facebook page and do it in that fashion as well. When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Gavin Newsom, Lieutenant Governor of the state of California, and also former mayor of San Francisco. Here's a web comment. Lieutenant Governor is in a position to help the Occupy movement achieve their aims of greater economic equality, reduced criminality in the banking sector, and less corrupting corporate influence in general. Yet in an interview, you called them extremists and asked, quote, what happens when we have absolutely nothing in common with their movement, end of quote. Such language suggests you are either in the best case out of touch with reality or worse, that you're identifying yourself as a part of the outlaw corporatism that has hijacked democracy.
I've got to say, I don't even recognize the quote. I think I established a strong point of view on this show, and I've established it in every interview.
I must confess to you, I have read most of what, if not all of what you've said on the Occupy movement, and I don't know where that quote is from either. So whoever put that on our website would please help us and give us the reference.
No, I'd appreciate that, and maybe it was wildly out of context, but that's not my point of view.
Let's go to other listeners. We'll go to caller in San Mateo. Jennifer, join us. Hi.
Hi. My question is about the cuts to early child care investment programs in the current budget proposal by Governor Brown. I really appreciate everything that Mr. Newsom's been saying about improving the sort of pipeline for developing a workforce and economic investment. However, empirically speaking, investing in early childhood programs, including and especially preschools, is actually the best return on investment in terms of overall economic development and reduction in other spending later down the line. And yet the governor's proposal really proposes dismantling the state-funded preschool programs for low-income children. And then there's also the sweep from the Prop 10 funds for First Five commissions that's still tied up in courts. And I'd just be interested to hear Mr. Newsom's comments on that.
Well, I could not agree with you more, and this is a point that needs to be highlighted over and over again. I was very proud as mayor to be part of an effort to fully implement universal preschool. I don't know of another big city and county in America that provides comprehensive early childhood education. San Francisco, we did it because we value not only your point of view, we value the notion that if you want to improve the K-12 education system, you've got to prepare people to enter into kindergarten in those formative years are fundamental and critical. That said, as mayor as well, I was very opposed to the efforts by the previous governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, to sweep those Prop 10 dollars, and disappointed that this governor, under very difficult circumstances, though I may add, and from an economic perspective and a budgetary perspective, is following that same path. So I completely concur with you. It's very disappointing. What's equally disappointing, perhaps more so, is that we have a Democratic governor proposing to cut welfare support to 2 years in an economy where we have 1.978 million people unemployed. We have 17 counties with unemployment north of 15%. We have counties like Imperial County at 26.8%. And we're talking about cutting welfare where 1 million of the 1.4 million people on CalWORKs are children in an economy, as I noted, where 23% of our children are living below poverty line, to cut welfare to just 2 years. And that's not gotten a lot of attention as well. So those two cuts, the one you just referenced and the welfare cut in addition to higher ed, are my top priorities in terms of contrasting the current governor's proposals.
Well, the cuts have been catastrophic. I mean, we've been covering them on so many levels, and the impact on just individual lives is you know, ineffable in terms of just describing how great and profound it is. But here's a question directly about cuts sort of in your bailiwick on the web. A listener writes, easy to complain about the cuts to higher education in California. Question is, what do you propose to fix it? Pension reform, tax reform, retirement benefits reform? I mean, the way that question is framed, I think, gets to the heart of a lot of it.
Well, sure. I mean, look, this was the critique that often I use as mayor, where I said, look, if you don't like my cuts, what else do you have? But at the same time, I understand the responsibility of balancing budgets. And I'll say this. I told this to the governor's staff. I said, well, if you don't like the Cal Grants cuts and you want to increase, they want to increase the GPA, it's disproportionately going to hurt African Americans, Latinos, another terrible cut. The governor said, what specifically you want to do in the alternative? I answered this way. I said, you give me your finance team, get me the controller, and give me your department heads, and give me 48 hours, and I'll come up with them. You've got to get in the mix. It's easy on the sideline to say, what else would you do? It's difficult to answer that without having the capacity of all those details and all those facts. We're still an extraordinarily wealthy state. There's a remarkable abundance of resources, not just from the public realm, but Also in the private realm, $4.5 billion of nonprofit investment in the state last year alone. There's ways of doing things differently. And higher education is, as I said, that conveyor belt for talent. The business community should be more concerned about this than any other budget line item. And yet the business community seems almost silent, I would argue almost complicit, by not stepping up and stepping in this debate and offering some alternatives in terms of resourcing a different narrative. The governor, to his credit, is proposing in the final $9.2 billion of cuts this year that they not be all cuts or the budget shortfall, that we balance it with about $5 billion of new revenue and about $4 billion of cuts to find some equilibrium there. And that's why the tax measures are important. I'll support it. But I do think it's about choice, not circumstances. And I'll make this final point. In 2007, Governor Schwarzenegger, facing an equally daunting budgetary challenge, invested an additional $750 million into higher education, despite the big budget deficit. I don't think this can be done. I know it can be done.
Speaking of business community, Erin Schubert had an article where she was talking about how busy you are and quoting your sister saying, I've never seen him busier. And now that he doesn't have any more local conflict, he's back involved in the Plump Jack business.
Oh, yeah.
The article goes on to say, then again, it does raise one important question. If Newsom is busier than ever running his own private business, why are we paying him a six-figure salary again?
My sister runs the business. She was particularly concerned about that article. No, all it was is I bought back the businesses that I sold. So she said back in. But no, this is a 24/7 job for me. It's interesting. You know, I was telling someone to what the point. I said, it's almost an activity trap being lieutenant governor. I'm traveling all over the state. I'm in Southern California about half the time, a little less than half the time. Yet I'm not feeling like I'm doing as much because I'm on these boards and commissions, but I'm not in that executive role. So it's more of an advisory role. So it sometimes gets frustrating. But interestingly, the schedule is not completely dissimilar than being mayor. Just again, without the depth of responsibilities. So trust me, I'd like to think you're getting your money's worth, though at times I imagine some people would feel differently.
Well, as I said, you're also multi-para now, meaning you have more than one child. And
that's right.
And a very dedicated father and husband. And your time is sort of pretty constricted, I imagine. I mean, especially with the commuting back and forth.
Yeah. Well, then maybe that's why I feel like I've never worked harder, especially this morning at 4:45 when my older woke up. But it's a wonderful gift having that balance. And I got to tell you, if I were mayor with two young kids, I'm not sure I could have done that. So it's nice to have this job, which gives me a little bit different perspective, and I'm a little less in the weeds and can look a little longer term at some of the big issues in the state.
And if you'd like to join us with Governor Newsom, please feel free to do it. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page or our website, kqed.org/forum. Let's go to Jack in San Francisco. Jack, you're on.
Hi, Gavin. Really thought you were an awesome mayor, San Francisco resident. And I commend you for your support of the Occupy movement, and I commend you for speaking out against the special interests and money in politics, you know. But I'm just curious, as a career politician, are you taking the chance of discarding the hand that will eventually feed you if you decide to run for governor or president of the United States someday? Because isn't that how these big elections are won? By special interest money. Thanks.
Let me answer that succinctly. The answer is unequivocally, absolutely yes. Of course. I can assure you my staff was probably cringing at the top of the hour. But it's what I say privately. And one thing I've survived. And again, everybody knows this listening. Guys like me come and go. We're a dime a dozen. You know, I always said when I was mayor, I'm the future ex-mayor, and this town's very happy with their new mayor. And, you know, not many folks are interested in my points of view about this city 24 hours after I was no longer mayor, when they cared deeply about it, for better or for worse, 24 hours prior to that. So you're given a moment in time. And one thing I'm not going to do is dream of regretting. I don't want to say things privately and not say them publicly. Somehow I've survived in political life about 16, 17 years by being myself. And I'm going to continue to try. And if I don't make it, if I don't become governor, that's fine. I have a wonderful life and wife and kids, multi-para, Is that the word,
Michael?
Para,
yeah. But you also have a legacy as a politician and as a mayor, and that legacy is important to you, isn't it?
Yeah, it is important. I mean, that's why, that's why I made reference on the Twitter thing. I'm sorry. Thank you for reminding folks that we were working on that for 9 months. Yeah, there is. It's an interesting thing. I want to have a therapy session with all those former mayors. I can imagine Mayor Brown. It must have been difficult. You get a new mayor in and they're showing up at groundbreakings or ribbon cuttings and things you've worked for 8 or 9 years. And you're forgotten and gone. That's fine. But there is, you have the private legacy of knowing that you did what you thought was right, even if you were wrong. And I feel great about my years as mayor. I didn't do everything I wanted to do, but I don't have many regrets. And that's where I want to be after I'm lieutenant governor and whatever I do in a political life, in life. I just don't want to regret. So I understand that the question, Jack's just dead on. And the system has to change. And until the system changes, Obama's going to play with the super PACs just like Romney or Gingrich is going to play with the super tax, even the PACs, even though everyone's complaining about it. But we got to do something about it so they don't have to be forced into a lousy system.
Richard from Mill Valley says, I'm interested in Lieutenant Governor Newsom's views on how to reverse the immense damage to California done by Prop 13.
Well, I mean, you got to amend it. You got to look at adjusting the impacts, or rather adjusting to the new realities and the impacts of Prop 13, intended and unintended. There's a lot of discussion about split rolls in adjusting the commercial and industrial taxes and maintaining them for residences. There's more debate on that than I've heard in some time. Governor Brown's decided not to go down that path at the moment. I understand the wisdom of that from a political perspective. But I think we have to have a robust debate about it.
We're going to go to a caller out of state here. Jeff joining us from, where are you in Pennsylvania, Jeff?
Clarion, Pennsylvania.
Right. Sorry, I don't recognize the Clarion call to Clarion, but you have Gavin Newsom here with us, and you have a question for him.
Yes, I do. I'm a physician here in rural Pennsylvania, and my family and I are at a point in our lives and in our career where making a break right now would just be a natural time. I would love to move to California. My wife is hesitant. With all we hear out east about what's going on in California, can you please, Governor, give me a few good reasons why we should move to California and I should practice out there?
Thank you for the question and the opportunity. Look, this is a state of dreamers, of doers, of entrepreneurs, of innovators that's always prided itself on being a leading cutting edge of new ideas. We have more scientists, more engineers, more researchers, more Nobel laureates than any other state in the nation. We had 25% of this nation's patents that emanated out of the state of California. Our economy is coming back. We're a global savvy economy, the world's ninth largest. We still have 5 of the top 10 universities on the planet. That's a literal, not a figurative statement. We have one of the most diverse democracies in the world's most diverse democracy. And I think by and large, people are living together and advancing together across every conceivable difference. This state is coming back. And when it does, I think it's going to blow up in a very positive way. And I just couldn't imagine being anywhere else. I mean that. I love Pennsylvania, but I couldn't imagine being anywhere else in the next few years than the state of California. So I'd highly encourage you to getting out here.
Good luck, Jeff. Thank you for your call. And here's a web comment that says, I agree California's tax rates are probably not the greatest barrier to economic growth, but don't our high land use costs, high utility rates, high workers' compensation costs, tort laws, and ongoing shortage of water make it difficult to attract manufacturing companies to the state? Why aren't our state leaders addressing these issues?
Yeah, he's right. The point of view is absolutely right. In my economic development plan, we haven't had, it's just an amazing thing. In 2003, we shut down our trade and commerce office. And as a consequence, we have no manufacturing and exports plan in this state. We've got to get back to an economy based on people and products, not paper and perks. Paper and perks got us in this mess. We have a robust manufacturing base in California, but it's slipping away at historic levels. We have got to focus back in on incentivizing manufacturing and reconciling some of the tax barriers that I do agree exist here that don't exist in other states that make it more difficult to do business here. And so I think the point was made is principled, and we have some very specific ideas in terms of as-of-right zoning, what we call plug-and-play zones, programmatic EIRs. We want to get rid of the sales tax disincentives for manufacturing equipment. We're one of 3 states that still has it. We have very specific ideas to begin to resolve that, and so I agree with the assessment.
And again, our guest is Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, and our next caller is Tom. Hi, Tom. You're on.
Hi, good morning. Apropos of what the Lieutenant Governor said about, I'm glad he said that, point out that we're still an extraordinarily wealthy state in spite of all our budget problems. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on what the, I believe the late David Brooks, well-known journalist, said about how the state's democratic system was, he used the word hijacked, but I think it was hijacked by the proposition system, state initiative system, with deep pockets money from out-of-state influence our democracy in California. And does he see a parallel between how state democracy and state's wealth are hijacked? Is there a parallel here?
I mean, it's a great question. Look, the initiative process in this state seems sacrosanct from the voter's perspective, but clearly it's been a big problem in this state. You contrasted states like Pennsylvania and others, that many states don't have the initiative process that we've come to know in California. And so you put something on the ballot, you have to have extraordinary wealth to support it, and those folks tend to have deep pockets. So there's disproportionate influence based on folks that have already achieved some success that they want to maintain or they want to enhance. It is a huge problem. I mean, you know, we've had discussions about it. There's been reform initiatives. Think Long Committee is one of the recent ones. California Forward has been talking about amending modestly the initiative process. But every time we put something up, folks say, no, I want that power to right the wrongs in Sacramento. So I think the only way that's going to change is we've got to have confidence that people are doing their job in Sacramento. And that will then give the voters confidence that they can take, or rather give back a little of their power to hold the legislature and the governor in check. So it's incumbent upon us.
But every poll we see shows that the confidence
is lower than ever.
It's lower than
I know.
Than,
so we got work to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, again, we have to be honest with folks, all the warts and all. And we have to be truthful about the games that we're playing up there. And we can't act holier than thou on either side of the political aisle and just blame one side or the other. As frustrating as is, and I'm a very passionate and proud Democrat, that we don't have the votes to do a lot of things we wanted to do with Republicans. At the same time, we have to look in the mirror in terms of our responsibilities to step up and compromise at the same time.
Speaking about being a passionate and proud Democrat, have you come out in favor of anybody replacing Lynn Woolsey now that you're living, in fact, in that district?
Yeah, Jared Huffman, who I've known, a great
Jared
environmentalist.
Huffman. Assemblyman Huffman.
Assemblyman
yeah.
Huffman, and I'm very supportive, though there are some, I hate to act like a politician, there are objectively some good candidates in the race that I know well. I just think Jared's the right person at the right time.
And here's some more people joining us by phone. Robert, hi, you're on.
Chris, good morning.
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 Gavin Newsom started off his remarks by decrying lobbyists and the influence of money in politics, and I tend to agree greatly. I'm curious what his feeling is about government funding of candidates for election, whereby influence of money is reduced and you still can maintain free speech with a limited contribution to each candidate, but the government would fund the candidates and thereby remove that great influence of money.
Okay, he's talking about public finance.
I've been supporting this forever. I've supported failing efforts, the Clean Money Initiatives and Clean Camp. The only way to go. I mean, if you want real change, but that's radical change, you've got to take away the remarkable influence that folks with deep pockets on all sides of the political aisle have, and that's a very disruptive prospect for folks that are doing quite well with the status quo. And I cannot support the notion of public financing more strongly at a national and statewide level. And we've seen the experiment locally in places like San Francisco, and we can quibble about exactly how one goes about publicly financing campaigns, and that's a good debate to have. But I think in broad strokes, it's principled.
Let me thank the caller, and let's get another caller right on here. That's you, Todd. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to tie a couple of comments that Governor Newsom made together and try to understand his point of view. I mean, from what I know of you and your comments, you clearly have had experience in the private sector. You're a successful businessman, so I think you understand economics and the impact of taxes. And then when you mentioned the impact of the potential impact of a change in the return of the Bush, undoing the Bush tax rates, that it didn't impact your decision to make a particular investment.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is that, I mean, we all know that if you had less money because you gave it to the government in taxes, that you wouldn't be able to make as many investments. And so taxes do have an impact on your ability to make investments and create jobs.
Right.
So why do you and other politicians on both sides of the aisle give sort of one-sided views instead of saying, look, there's a trade-off here. Yes, if I pay higher taxes, I'll be able to make less investments, create fewer jobs, but it's a good trade-off, and here's why.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. And in subsequent conversation, I tried to make the point you've got to be competitive vis-a-vis states and cities. But look, at the end of the day, what I care about as a small business person, and every one of the businesses I've opened, is that there's demand. And if there's demand, then we will move forward with investment. And so you've got to create conditions where people are participating actively in economic life of their community, in the economic ecosystem. That said, you're right. You have taxes that can be usurious that I do agree hinder investment and economic growth. But with respect to going back to the Clinton era tax rates, I think we proved remarkable capacity to grow our economy with those rates, 21 to 22 million jobs during those years, the last four surpluses since trickle-down economics was put into place in 1981, occurred in the second term of the Clinton administration. In contrast that to the Bush administration, where in the 7 years and 8 months before 9/11, we created only 2.5 million jobs, and most of them were in the defense industry and in other public sector, not private sector areas. So I just think the evidence suggests that going back to the Bush tax rates is not going to hinder our economy, but going to 50% or 75%, as some are arguing, I think could, to your point.
Let's get David on here quickly. David, hi, you're on.
Yeah, I want to ask Gavin how he can talk about getting the money out of politics when I feel like he accepted money from Sunset Scavenger and then allowed them to nickel and dime us with fees like vacation hold fees, $10 if you want to put your garbage on hold, and they make an excuse that, oh, it's so complicated. Hey, it's no more complicated than telling the Chronicle to put on vacation hold, and now they nickel and dime us with this $10 vacation hold fee. Why did you agree to that?
Okay, let's get a quick response.
You got me on that. I do recall requiring you to compost, so, you know, shame on me if you oppose that. Look, I'm not acting holier than thou here. I am suggesting, and look at, you know, I've got to go out and fundraise to be relevant. I had to fundraise to become mayor. I had to fundraise to become lieutenant governor, particularly in a state our size. And so I'm participating just as the Obama administration's participating in the system that exists today. I'm just arguing, and because I don't want, you know, you don't want to, as Obama's folks are saying on the super PAC, we're not going to just unilaterally disarm and watch our opponents crush us as we work to try to fix this system. And the president was very aggressive in his condemnation of the Citizens United initiative. So that's sort of my framework.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Gavin Newsom. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. Mm-hmm. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller here, and Jack, that's you from Davis. Hi, Jack.
Hi, I was listening and didn't get to hear all the things that was said about Proposition 13, but my mother is 91, and she's lived in her house since 54, so she's profited from the benefits of Proposition 13. But what about all the people that bought real estate or commercial properties that are still benefiting from those same reduced taxes? So if you could provide an opportunity for an increased tax for people that are using their properties, their Proposition 13 properties as rentals.
Yeah.
It might be able to be...
Jack, the division has come up many times in this program about, treating personal property one way and commercial property another way with Prop 13.
Yeah, and that's what I was arguing that I think is growing consensus. That's an area where we can see some impact because we're getting closer and closer to, I think, both sides of the political aisle acknowledging that the issues of transferability of commercial and industrial space, there are loopholes that can be closed, and the issue of the sanctity of protecting a 91-year-old mother, in your case, is critical in terms of maintaining some basis and principle calls Prop 13 as it relates to the residential side. Yeah, but I have a stronger point of view on taxes. We have to dramatically restructure our tax system in the state of California. We're no longer we're rather now an economy that's dramatically service-oriented, and as a consequence, we need to tax those things that the economy actually is producing, which is more service, and we have an opportunity in this state to have a different kind of dialogue than just raising the existing tax rates and start restructuring dramatically the overall tax system. And I hope Governor Brown takes a look at this in the next year or two, and I know a lot of us are going to encourage him to do that.
And I thank Jack for the call. Here's Wayne, who writes actually about Lawrence Lessig, who appeared on the show and talked about this. He says, how do we get big money out of politics? Lawrence Lessig proposes limiting political contributions to $50 per person, which, if I have it right, this $50 would be given to each individual through a tax rebate specifically to be used to support the candidate of their choice. Another listener says, Gavin is lost in the San Francisco political bubble. He represents perhaps 5% of the political thought of America as a whole. Maybe if you'd better represent your constituents by moving to the center, you'll have more success. What would you say to him?
I don't know. People argued that I was the compassionate conservative in San Francisco and said I was, we didn't raise taxes. I tried to cut taxes. I was a pro-business Democrat and someone that strongly believes in.
I think with people like Chris Daley, you were a reactionary.
Yeah,
weren't you?
I was the reactionary conservative. I mean, I don't know. I was elected statewide in a state that goes back and forth in statewide elections to more moderate and more progressive candidates. And I think my record speaks for itself. I think when it comes to social issues, it's certainly progressive. But fiscal issues, I think I have a well-established moderate record.
We've got seconds left. Here's Barbara, who says, is there a way to save the California Commission on the Status of Women? You know, especially in light of your wife's work, that we have a long way to go to protect the rights and lives of women and women and families. It will be a wonderful day when we don't need it, but this is not the day. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with that. Look at all these budget cuts. Who they disproportionately impact? Women and girls. We're not having that debate in this state. We're not having that debate in this country. And the impact of women and girls is profound in terms of our ability to succeed economically. So I think the commission has a very vital role to play. I think it could be more robust in terms of playing that role. San Francisco, of course, had an extraordinary commission, and they're very powerfully leading the charge to reverse this proposal by Governor Brown.
And finally, a question you hear a lot. Does Mr. Newsom have any plans to run for governor or a federal office, like president, in the future? I've been a faithful supporter. Would love to see his political career continue.
God bless. We'll see. I've made no bones that if the opportunity presents itself at governor. I don't like politicians to say, they give the usual answer. I ran for governor briefly, as you recall, for a reason. I want to represent the state, and I've made the point as well as lieutenant governor. Sometimes it's a little frustrating not being more involved in the day-to-day activities from the executive branch. So I think there's a chance for that.
Well, we'll still give you your official title, Governor Newsom. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for
having
me.
Good to have you
back
on. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Ferro, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.